Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comics podcast on AIPTComics.com. My name is David Brook and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Forrest, how you doing?
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's. David, is like 10 a.m. I've been awake for what the folks would conservatively call 10 minutes. I'm getting jacked up on Red Bull and increasingly excited to talk about comics, though.
That is the perfect breakfast to start any podcast, I think. This is the comic book podcast where we talk about the latest news, we recap the week, we talk about our favorite comics, and we have guests on too. Later in the show, Steve Orlando is going to be on the show to talk about The Pull, a new TKO series, part of their Wave 3. And they don't put out many books, folks, so it's quite an awesome, I would say, honor. I think even Steve says, an honor to be part of Wave 3. We talk all about The Pull. We also talk about Commanders in Crisis, Killer Man, some other things. We talk about process. Yeah, so hang on. That's later in the show. But before we talk about, before we talk to Steve, we're going to recap the news. And in the top of our news, there's a bit of drama, I'd say.
Sure. Yeah. Deserved criticism.
Yes. That's even better. And it all revolves around Fantastic Four number 26. And before we get into it, we're going to be getting into spoilers here. So if you haven't read Fantastic Four number 26 and want to and not want to be spoiled, skip ahead probably 5 to 10 minutes.
Yes.
Because we're going to be talking, we're going to get in depth on why a specific retcon was making the waves on Twitter in particular, but I'm sure people across the lands were particularly offended by a story element in this that involved Franklin Richards, the son of Reed and Sue Richards.
Mm-hmm.
So to start, let's just get into why or what it was that happened in the book. About a third way in the book, Franklin, if you do not know, is an Omega level mutant or was. And it turns out he wants to go to Krakoa. He wants to be part of the mutant community and is stonewalled by Xavier before he can use a gizmo to do so because Xavier lets him know, actually, you were never a mutant and you've been faking it the whole time with your Omega level powers. And while Franklin wasn't aware that he was faking it, it still stands that apparently, even though since the early 90s he's been a mutant, he no longer is a mutant. Yes, and never was.
I mean, a significant portion of Onslaught and other events are centered around his mutantdom, including this year's Fantastic Four X-Men, written by Chip Zdarsky, which is primarily about Franklin's identity crisis and, you know, the politics of allowing people that he doesn't want to live on Krakoa full time. There's a bit of a push and pull between Magneto and Xavier and Richard and Sue.
Yes,
Reed.
Yeah.
Reed. Richard.
Reed Richards, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Character, yeah, so book.
Basically, you know, like I said before, Franklin wants to be part of the mutant culture. And
yes,
his parents, in that story by Chip Zdarsky, are pushing back. They don't want him to leave the house, the nest that they've built, and they want him to stay. And, you know, it's part of who he is to be a mutant, at least in that story arc.
Yeah, and so this is delivered in a one-page, very expository dialogue, pretty much one-sided from Xavier, where he shows up to Franklin as a psychic projection, basically. And he says, Franklin, you wanted to be a mutant so bad you were inspired by them. You wanted to be part of their community. You wanted to be special. That since you were a child, you have been using your cosmic powers to express the X gene. It is not valid. You are no longer welcome on Krakoa.
Right. He's been spoofing the gene and making people believe he's a mutant.
Yes.
So, right. So, yeah. Get into why people reacted the way they did.
I want to say, I think first, there's just a structural problem with the way that this is delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is a one-page, almost non-contextualized moment in the issue.
Yeah.
That it pitches up and then hits a decades-long retcon. It is weird narratively. I think it mischaracterizes both Franklin and Xavier. It's not well done narratively in the book, and especially in the larger context of kind of the editorial and creative direction of the X books, which Franklin is very much a part of. I mean, he was on Krakoa very recently.
Yeah, in the very last issue of Fantastic Four.
The last issue. And so it kind of feels like Slott is at odds creatively with the rest of what's happening at Marvel. And I think that that's a problem in and of itself. But I also think that there is a problem if we can narrow in on, I think that queer people, I have a trans friend that was very upset by this. I have a Jewish friend that was very upset by this retcon, for numerous reasons, but one that I will try to express, especially as a queer person, as a bi person who does not always feel that my identity is valid or feels that my identity is very fluid and that I kind of straddle the space between two communities. If you were a trans woman who was mid-transitioning or has transitioned into being a trans woman, this story, by virtue of the implication from Xavier, from the dialogue of the characters and the perspective of the characters that we're supposed to empathize and sympathize with, is saying you are not a part of that, you know, female community, and you never will be. That's not valid.
Mm-hmm.
Which is inherently harmful and disingenuous, and I think short-sighted. It also inadvertently or more directly accuses Franklin of, like, blackface.
Right, right. Yeah, because he was pretending to be something he wasn't.
So it's not even that he is hurt or that he's being barred from a community that he very much should and can be a part of, I think, still. But it's also making him a villain.
Right.
And I think that there are just numerous problems with this, to say nothing of how Slott has responded to the criticism online.
He's been very outspoken.
Very valid, warranted criticism from, I mean, an Eisner Award-winning trans comic journalist tweeted out and explained the problems with the story much better than I can or ever will be able to, because those aren't my specific struggles or our specific struggles. And Slott basically first subtweeted them and then directly replied to her and was saying stuff like, I don't know that I've ever actually hurt a trans person. If you can give me one clear example of how I've hurt a trans person, I want to talk to that person and have that discussion. And the cognitive dissonance there, to have a person who has already expressed what the problem is, for you to reply and say, I don't think that there's a problem. If there is, tell me the specific person I need to talk to. While you are talking to that person?
Yeah.
Is a lot.
Yeah, it is.
Is a lot.
Yeah. It's a lack of awareness. I mean, you saw it in the story, and then you see it in his reactions on Twitter.
Slott is being very woe is me about it in a way that I don't appreciate. You know, he did a kind of... I appreciate that he is not calling out or singling out any specific criticism, any specific person. Because I think it is maybe unfair or inappropriate for someone with that many followers to direct a warranted or unwarranted critical voice towards other people who have less followers or less safeties in place. But at the same time, like, he is so obviously responding with their criticism without actually engaging with them, that it's like he's steering the narrative in a way I don't appreciate, much like his comics.
Yeah, it's like he's saying they don't have a case. Right. They're, you know, they're overly emotional or whatever. And so let's just move on. So it's like debasing them and not hearing them out, which is unfortunate. You know, I'm very curious to see if this narrative thread of Franklin's lack of being a mutant for all time, apparently, continues in this series, or if he's done with it.
So I get the impression that, I mean, the way it's delivered in only one page.
Right. And it's like, we're done.
Right. And, you know, I think that that is what he's trying to make Xavier do in the story.
Yeah.
But also, like, this is iterative, cyclical storytelling. Franklin's still going to exist when Dan Slott isn't writing him. Like, this story is, by virtue of the nature of comics, not over.
Sure. Yeah.
And
in
that
10 years, someone can just reverse this.
And that may be by design. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to say there may be more to this story. I think it would be really weird to have Fantastic Four X-Men come out earlier this year and to not address it at all after this kind of retcon.
Right.
It's very possible that future issues of X-Men or Fantastic Four will delve into this issue more. And I think that they should.
Yeah, they should. Mm-hmm.
But also, it is delivered and handled so poorly in this issue that the value proposition that you would stick around to read that follow-up is difficult. I'm being flippant now, but to be quite honest, a nuclear Fantastic Four family story doesn't interest me at all.
Yeah.
So, like, fast-tracking it to that is, like, the least interesting endpoint to begin with.
Yeah, I was really excited last issue when we saw Franklin and Krakoa and how that might, you know, blend together. But apparently not.
Yeah.
That's not on the menu.
I'm very bothered by it. I'm really, really upset by Slott reading valid criticism from a trans woman about how this is damaging and harmful to trans women, specifically herself, and then saying, I don't believe you, and or point me to the person.
Right.
It's right. Very frustrating. It's very frustrating. I'm sorry.
It's tone deaf.
Yeah.
And like back to what I was saying, like Marvel doesn't, I mean, in general, with other, you know, cases like this, they just ignore and move on. And you know, if again, I guess, and we say this on the show constantly, you gotta vote with your wallet.
Yeah.
That's the only way I think for Marvel to even care or listen.
Absolutely. I mean, I understand no ethical consumption under capitalism and all those things that we could talk to death. I get it. Like if the Fantastic Four are important to you, or if you are someone who has, you know, read every other Fantastic Four issue or every Marvel issue, even, I get it, but man.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
It sucks. Can we talk about something not this?
Moving on. talking Thank about...
You. I love how artificial this pivot is just because we're like, all right, fuck this dude.
Talking about wallets, Robert Kirkman released original Walking Dead pitch and proposal. And in his pitch and proposal, he said, guess what? It's black and white. It's going to be cheaper to make these comics.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate the boldness of that. Or maybe not the boldness. The art here, I was really struck by how unrefined the art is.
Yeah, so comicbook.com has this, has the pitch is comic book pages, art from the book, from his pitch. I mean, it's only the pitch, right? This isn't even in the book.
Yeah.
And it's kind of fascinating that they pitched Image Comics like this with The Walking Dead.
I think that this is a semi-frequent process. It's called an ash can.
Yeah.
When you only make like half of the story. And that's like, man, you have to also put a second cliffhanger into your ash can.
Mm.
It's interesting. He also wrote up a proposal, a 22-page black and white book, just like the best horror movies, yeah. Cutting down on minimal printing costs, as you said. And that he, and then he goes into describing Carol and Rick very, very kind of briefly.
Right.
It's interesting, you know, I like that he just put this out when this could be a variable, very valuable thing in and of itself.
Yeah, they could have released this, right?
Yeah, I mean, Walking Dead is such a valuable property that you would think they would release like a $5, throw some extra character sketches or whatever in and make an additional $5 off of it.
I wonder if Marvel Comics would pull something like that.
It increasingly seems to me like Kirkman is, in fact, actually done with Walking Dead.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that they put it out now. I mean, they could have easily have just released this at any time. I mean, it wouldn't have ruined the story or anything. But they're, like, now showing us how the cookies were made, essentially. Which I guess, in a way, takes a little bit of the luster off of the series, in a sense. Or it could have if they had released this midway through the Walking Dead run.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a neat way to see how, you know, there are... At this point, we've seen multiple different, you know, ways people have pitched. I mean, like Grant Morrison pitching new X-Men, and now this. Like, it's fascinating to me that, you know, people take chances and do different things in the same medium. But yeah, so check that out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, also, check out. I just appreciate the peek into the creative process. Right.
Right. It's neat. Right. So if you're a Chris Claremont fan, you had a treat this week on Reddit. Chris Claremont did an AMA answering folks' questions. And I don't know if you've ever sat through a Chris Claremont question and answer series. He's done it quite a bit over conventions over the last, you know, 30 years. But once again, the rule of never meet your heroes might be a rule to take with this AMA.
Yeah, so specifically one question from a Reddit user named Magic160 is the one that I wanted to call out, where they said, real question, but I wanted to thank you for some of my all-time favorite X-Men and New Mutant characters and stories, especially your work on Magic. I even got her on my arm and attached a picture of their Magic tattoo. That's Magic the character, M-A-G-I-K, Ilanya Rasputin. He says in response, thank you. Well, that's creepy, considering Magic is fundamentally evil as a character that can be imagined. The irony with Magic is that deep down inside, she knows she's evil. She is so evil, she would scare Lucifer on the TV series half to death. But there's a part of her that doesn't want to be evil. The superhero part of her. Heaven help everybody if she loses. How very Russian of her.
What a wacky response.
There is so much to unpack in that. The weird detour into the Lucifer TV show.
Yeah, that's very specific.
Describing a character as fundamentally evil.
Yeah, like, also very weird and off if you've been reading X-Men comics in the last year or more.
Yeah. And also to tell a Magic, I'm going to say super fan, that directly. It's just like a degree of not caring.
Yeah, it's very mean.
And admire and think it's incredibly cruel.
It is. It is. So tone deaf.
I really get what he means by very Russian of her.
Apparently Russians are super evil.
I don't know if... Yeah, okay, it's like... You could say that's like Russophobia. Which is an Americanized problem in and of itself. Or a comics problem more specifically in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But then also, I'm wondering if he means this eternal struggle between... This stark struggle between good and evil and kind of like the god and devil is very Russian, metaphorically or textually, which is true. Like a lot of Russian narrative and even religion and stuff is focused on that. And I wonder if that's what he means, but then also it's like, this is obviously transcribed by someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's actually writing these responses.
But oh, you think so?
I think he's probably not. Yeah, feeding them to a Marvel person, given the way that it is written, some of the other answers are written. But man, what a weird, weird thing.
I think my favorite was someone asked about Cyclops. And he says, my problem is I thought Scott was a wonderful character until his moment he walked out on Madeline and went back to Jean, and that was dishonorable and destroyed him as a character. literally that moment has ruined the character for him for all time.
Yeah.
Which is, it's just, to the Magic point too, doesn't he realize this is serial storytelling? The characters don't just stop existing after you stop writing them.
Right.
It's kind of a ego.
Well, actually, I think I got quite the impression from some of the answers that he doesn't think that.
Right.
Someone asked him about his other favorite Marvel runs and writers, and he literally says, not many come to mind.
Right.
I like Frank Miller's Daredevil.
It's weird, right?
Which also, really? That's the one? Okay.
I know, right? Yeah, I mean, it's... When I was reading that, too, I was thinking, was this just an easy answer for an old man who hasn't read comics in 25 years?
It's possible. It is.
Because, Daredevil... Frank Miller's Daredevil was, the go-to for people for the longest time, but hasn't been for a long time, too.
Yeah.
It's so weird to me that a man who lived with these characters and did so much good with the characters doesn't read the characters. You think he'd still, miss them in a way and want to experience them.
I mean, I guess the other side of the coin is Rob Liefeld won't shut the fuck up. So maybe, I prefer Claremont. I don't know. I have a friend
who and yang of comics.
I have a friend who was held hostage by Claremont. They were trying to get a signature on one of their comics. Just get it signed. And he, gave them a review of the Fast and the Furious series.
Oh my god, that's funny.
And was just, moving the Sharpie around while talking and not
signing.
Did
he like it?
He has some thoughts.
Interesting.
I think, it's very weird to read the entire AMA, which I think people should do. It's over on the comic book subreddit. But, he obviously has a predilection for movies and TV series over comics and literature.
Mm, for sure. Yep.
And that's just
which is also interesting.
A weird thing. Yeah.
I don't know. You wouldn't expect that.
Yeah. I mean, you should like whatever you like, but also, I don't know.
He's not
the person people think he is. And if you aren't convinced of that, you really should read that interview it's like a laugh out loud funny, both intentionally and unintentionally.
you know, being tapped into comics for a little while now myself, like, it is funny, you see it reoccurring over and over. You see people who idolize Claremont, then meet him or read one of these and realize who he might really be.
Yeah.
And then they're like crushed. It's like a circle. You just keep seeing it happening. But, you know, the way the internet is, people, only a handful of people will have read this AMA, and in 5 years he'll do another one and people will be like, what did you think of Hawks and Pox?
And he'll be older and grumpier.
Yes, right. Grumpy old man. They should have Chris Claremont and Tim Seeley do the Fast and the Furious Bloodshot crossover we talked about a couple weeks ago. Yeah. That'd be interesting. Yeah. Oh, Tim could draw it. Tim could draw it, and Chris will write it.
Man.
Moving away from old crusty stories, Marvel Comics has released their February 2021 solicitations. And once again, not a ton of surprises, because they basically reveal everything over the 2 or 3 weeks before they come out. There were a couple of surprises just this week, though, before they came out, like Marvel Voices Legacy number 1 coming out, Avengers Mech Strike coming out, and Black Panther finally getting solicited again, and will finally finish Ta-Nehisi Coates' story arc.
In February.
Yes. Yeah, so... Again, not a lot of surprises. King in Black continues to take over almost every series. So if you're not into that, you may not have a lot to read on the Marvel side of things.
You know, I sighed out loud because the last event that I read every tie-in and main series issues of was Absolute Carnage. And before that was Spider-Geddon.
Yeah.
And I really thought, like, I was like, I'm not going to do that with King in Black. It's too much. And then I was looking through all the covers and the solicits, and I was like... Back on the horse. Gonna read all of this.
It looks like Marvel's making up for not having as many Empire tie-ins by adding more tie-ins to King in Black.
Yeah.
I am here for Nonstop Spider-Man. That looks so good.
It does. Kelly and Chris Bachalo. I'm glad to have an alternative Spider-Man book.
For real.
I'm also very excited by it is a King in Black tie-in to begin with, but Matthew Rosenberg is tackling Thunderbolts.
Yeah, that's cool.
And he tweeted that he was hopeful that it would turn into a full-fledged series if it does well. So I'm very excited by that. I think that's cool. This is the last Wolverine Black, White, and Blood. This will be number 4 of 4. The creative teams on this book. What a flex. Like, you got Paolo Sequeira, Kyrie Randolph, Kelly Thompson, Ed Brisson, several others. They really threw everything at that.
I'm excited for Stephen S. DeKnight's stuff, because he's worked in TV, like the Daredevil show and stuff, and he's getting more and more work at Marvel. I'm wondering if he's like the next, I don't want to say Christopher Cantwell, because he's also from TV, but Marvel keeps tapping these TV creators and bringing them into the realm of their series, which is good and bad, right? I mean, it's bad in that, you know, up-and-comers who are just people off the street trying to make it have less work, but it's good because if you like their shows and their content, you're going to get more content of that higher quality. The X-Books also rage on. Did you see Cable is dating Domino?
Domino, yeah. That's fantastic. The Vault book that we spoke about, I think last week, is actually coming out at that time.
Vault book? Which Vault book?
You know, Laura and Sync and all those others coming out.
X-Men. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It looks like a cool month.
I wanted to call out specifically real quick, Planet of the Symbiotes number 2.
Yes.
That is a King in Black tie. And the first issue is written by Frank Thierry, which, The second, though, caught my attention because it has American Kaiju, a personal favorite character, on the cover. And Mark Bernardin, whose stuff I've not read before, tweeted out, Marvel, do you want to write a short story about American Kaiju? Me. Who? Marvel. Army dude who becomes, well, Godzilla. Me. Can it be a metaphor for American force doctrines and the myth of exceptionalism? Marvel. As long as he smashes buildings and symbiotes, sure. Me. I'm in. I am so excited by this.
That could be really cool.
All of the best Godzilla movies are actually about the people. All of the best kaiju stories are actually about, you know, government mismanagement, the sociopolitical and governmental forces that allow those things to happen. And in the guise of a really cool, already inherently cool symbiote story, just put it in my veins, dude.
It is cool. Like, you know, you don't have to read some of the, some of these tie-ins are going to definitely be like a stepping stone in the event and you probably should read them. But others like this one probably are going to have their own little side story and that you don't even need to read if you're not reading King in Black. You could read just this if you're into that kind of thing.
Like a good third of it seems like a Christmas series too. So
with Santa.
Yeah.
Dr. Doom and Iron Man team up to fight Santa.
Yeah. And there's a good cover, an Adam Kubert cover that has Hulk in a sleigh being pulled by some of the symbiote gargoyles.
Mm.
I'm into it.
Also, because of the solicitations coming out, news came out that certain books are being pulled from the schedule, including Web of Spider-Man. Also, Children of the Atom is skipping a month, apparently. Customary of Marvel, they don't explain these things. It just sort of happens and then people react. But yeah, the 5-issue Web of Spider-Man series may not be coming, or it may be coming later
so
in the year.
So Marvel reassured retailers, they said that new on-sale dates will be announced as soon as possible, but they're not committing to any sort of timeline for this one. Chris Aaron over at Newsarama called out a very interesting reason why, which is that Web of Spider-Man specifically ties into a ride. What do you call it? Amusement park ride?
Sure.
And I almost said a public park ride. Can you imagine?
Sort of.
Kind of. Public park. Yeah.
I want that. We need more of that.
Given that how the pandemic has affected theme parks, Aaron says it's conceivable that their 2021 launch plans might be postponed or at least put into question. Which is why they've delayed this book in particular. I just thought that was a really interesting cross-section of a lot of different properties and things coming together.
Interesting that there's going to be a Spider-Man ride at Disney, because I guess, does that mean Universal's losing their control over the Marvel properties?
Oh, I don't know.
I wonder what's going on with that.
I don't know.
Yeah. Huh. It's kind of interesting. Synergy.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah, right. So it's not just Marvel Comics that has new series coming out. There's other publishers too, including Dark Horse, which they announced a new Black Hammer limited series called Visions. It starts in February, and it has a treasure trove of incredible comics talent like Chip Zdarsky, Scott Collins, Colin Bunn, Kelly Thompson, Mariko Tamaki, Cecil Castellucci, on and on, Patton Oswalt, Jeff Johns, Scott Snyder. Some of these people can literally make a Charlie Brown comic that is only the dirty guy in it, and he's the main character, and they would still sell 20,000 copies. Linus, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
The stinky one.
Linus, the stinky one.
Scott Snyder to be drawing, or he has a new series called The Stinky One, and it would sell 20,000 copies.
Maybe, so, in the vein of Spawn and The Darkness,
yeah,
The Stinky One, beckoning back to the classic era of indie comic storytelling.
I mean, he has that big Savage Dragon, like Spawn's cape,
incest, as the Savage Dragon books have turned into.
On February 10th, the first issue comes out, written by Patton Oswalt with art by Dean Kotz and Jason Wordy. Jeff Lemire tweeted out like, hey, guess what? They're making Black Hammer comics and I'm not writing them.
Pretty neat. You know, I think I actually said this last week too. I always have a really good time reading Black Hammer comics. I like them very much. I really like them in a microcosm of individual issues or individual runs. I do worry that this series is getting a little bigger than its means.
This
is only four or five years old, and I feel like you need comprehensive reading orders for the entire thing at this point. And they're sometimes cross-publisher, cross-writer, cross-artist. Like, it's getting very complicated very quickly.
I imagine a lot of these writers are going to be interested in doing their own thing too, right?
Right.
Introducing possibly new characters, but if not, new adventures for characters that we already know. It's kind of exciting, though. Also, Dark Horse is launching a new series called Fear Case. This is by Matt Kint.
I like him.
Tyler Jenkins and Hillary Jenkins.
I like all of them.
That's the creative team behind Grass Kings, which is from Boom Studios. That was a huge success, critically acclaimed. This series catches my eye because it reminded me of The Department of Truth.
Oh, okay.
Let me read the synopsis. It is a True Detective meets The Ring. in Fear Case as a no-nonsense Secret Service agent and his partners investigate a mysterious box known only as the Fear Case, which has appeared throughout history at sites of disaster and tragedy. Whoever comes into possession of this case must pass it on within 3 days or face deadly consequences. The agents must track down this Fear Case while staying one step ahead of a psychotic cult and the otherworldly forces behind the case's existence. Sounds insane. Comes out February 3rd.
Yeah.
I can't wait. More secret agents trying to solve secret agent crimes that are super supernatural. Super supernatural. That's an interesting sentence. not supernatural, SiriusXM. Do you listen to SiriusXM? Because soon, Marvel Entertainment is launching 3 new podcasts in 2021. They actually already started one new podcast called Marvel Method, hosted by your man, Method Man. but they also have Marvel's Declassified. Yeah, and then Marvel's Wastelanders, which is going to be focusing on the alternate, you know, Old Man Logan universe characters. So, yeah, if you want to listen to these 3 new shows, they're all only on SiriusXM.
And like, to clear something up, as a SiriusXM subscriber, they have a web streamer and they have an app as well. Like, it isn't like you need to tune into a specific channel and find these at a specific time, like regular radio. You'll have the ability to play them back. It's not really any different than, like, Stitcher or Earwolf.
I don't need to get, like, bunny ears and put them on my roof.
No. I would love to see the metrics on this. I would love to see the details of the deal between Marvel and Sirius, too. Just to know how profitable it is or what their projections are.
So, the Marvel's Wolverine the Long Night originally wasn't hosted on SiriusXM. It was another program. I don't have it on the tip of my tongue, but it must have been a huge success, and they probably used those numbers to sell Sirius to get a better deal.
That makes
right?
sense. I mean, yeah.
Logical.
Yeah.
You can also listen to their other podcasts like Marvel's Pull List on SiriusXM, but those will be available elsewhere as well, so you don't have to necessarily get SiriusXM to listen to their tried and true podcasts. And then our last bit of news. Image Comics is pretty good at superheroes, but they don't necessarily introduce new ones very often. But they will in February with a new book called Radiant Black. It's from Kyle Higgins and Marcelo Costa. Kyle Higgins, of course, has a pedigree of superheroes like Power Rangers and Ultraman. And in fact, for this book, Image is calling it Power Rangers meets Invincible, which is a weird combo. Power Rangers is a team space ranger book, and Invincible is a solo hero Superman sort of story. I'm not sure how that works, but it looks cool.
Image is going to keep trying things until they get the next Walking Dead.
Now, if they introduce, like, you know, Radiant Black meets Spawn in issue 3, we know there might be a problem with sales. Just keep that in mind.
True.
Moving on to our next segment, our top books of the week. We're going to talk about our top books, our favorite comics that came out this week. Can I go first?
You can.
My favorite comic of the week is Frank at Home on the Farm, number 1, by Jordan Thomas and Clark Bent. This is a book from Scout Comics. You can't access these books digitally. You have to go to a comic book store. But if you go and request it, they will gladly order it for you because we talked about this last week a little bit, but Scout Comics are now putting out new number 1 issues and then waiting 2 months to put out another issue. So you have a little bit to order this book and read it.
Yeah.
But this book just... an amazing horror story. It's about a man who went to World War I, comes back to meet his family and at their farm, and unfortunately they're gone. And then he is frantically looking for them, goes to town, no one knows who they are. And yet we keep seeing the farm animals looking at him very strangely. So there's some kind of mystery going on. Something's happened to the family and something's going on with the animals. The art is, you know, very detailed, very cool and clean looking. It actually reminded me of Richard Corbin's work. He's done a lot of Dark Horse books, older artist. There's like this hyper detail around like eyes or mouths, but then there's like a very clean face, and the way the skin is colored is very realistic looking. So it creates this sort of bizarreness to the characters. They're almost slightly cartoony, but still somehow realistic with their detailing. And it's perfectly matched for the story, which also plays with light and shadow amazingly, like just light shooting through windows, you know, onto like a bedspread. There are like clear outlines from the trees or something that's like blocking the window. You can see it on the bed, which again creates this surrealistic but realistic look that is also is bizarre, but also like pulls you into this reality. This first issue, I can't say enough how it's so worth reading. And they're dubbing it something like Twin Peaks meets some horror movie. I forget the one that they marked. Yeah, it's I think the Twin Peaks aspect is it doesn't necessarily give you answers. It's just the, you kind of mellow out in the weirdness. And then you're like, well, this is kind of cool. Let's hang out here. Yeah, it's highly recommended. And yeah, you have 2 months until the second issue comes out. So no worry about missing it or falling behind.
Okay.
Forrest, what was your favorite book of the week?
So, Dave, I didn't do my homework.
Oh, no.
This week.
Did the dog eat it?
I accidentally saved over it. And so I can try to recover it, but it won't be until next week. No, I did read Venom number 30. And there's a column up about that with my good friend Justin at Xavier Files. But I didn't like it very much.
Yeah.
So my suggestion for this week is that you should read the 1995 series Planet of the Symbiotes. Which King of Black is invoking. This was written by David Michelinie. It's a, I think, a five-part series. It features Eddie Brock, Spider-Man, Scarlet Spider, Carnage. They actually end up going to the home planet of the Symbiotes, which is an increasingly important plot element in the current Venom run. There's also some fantastic, really goopy, gross, goth-driven art by the likes of like Derek Robertson and Kyle Hotz and Steve Littley. It's a fantastic, really kooky, weird, funny series that is, it starts playing around with the elements that are very prevalent in the Venom movie, which is the idea of like, is Eddie in charge or is the Venom symbiote in charge? Kind of harkens back to the idea that the symbiote suit was driving Peter Parker when he had it as well, right? Or that he was going out and doing things at night that he wasn't aware of. I think that's a very fantastic, interesting plot point. I also feel like this is one of the first times that Venom starts to feel like a very separate book from Spider-Man. They really start to push it in this really interesting, existential, cosmic horror, sci-fi angle that a lot of the other Spider-Man properties weren't exploring at the time. There are some scenes that straight up feel like Aliens, the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, that felt like a... Well, I haven't read it since I was a kid, but it felt like an inspiration for the series at the time.
Yeah, I think very much so. Also, none of this is invalidated by the current run. So this is all still happening in continuity. I've always been a fan of this series. It's always been one of my go-to, like, okay, 90s comics were bad, but also good examples. I enjoy it very much. I think people should check it out. It's kind of like where my mind's at on the cusp of King in Black.
So it's a better precursor than the last Venom story arc.
Yes.
I think you'd agree.
Yes, absolutely.
We talked about this, I think, once on the show, or maybe it was off the air, but like, what the hell, Donny Cates?
Yeah.
You're setting up your event with this nothing, not nothing, but quite an off story arc to get us geared up.
I will say a terrible time for us to launch our Goop Troop column, because I think anyone that has read the ones that we have done thinks we absolutely hate Venom.
Oh, true. Oh,
which
yeah,
is,
true.
Very much not how I feel.
Well, you have King in Black coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully it'll turn around. I don't know.
Are you guys going to cover like all
so
all of King
some
in Black?
Of those books fall under other people's columns.
Got it.
And they will write those or tag one of us in to assist with writing them, I think. But given that I'm reading all of it anyway, in order, I'm going to read every King in Black issue, tie-in, whatever. I'm happy to write up or discuss anything.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Moving on to our next segment, top books for next week. We're going to talk about our number one most anticipated comic out next week. Forrest, what do you got?
I have no surprises. The Department of Truth number 3. This is written by James Tynion with art by Martin Simmons. We've been very hot on this series. We've been very, I almost said apologetic. That can't possibly be the right word.
Excited?
Yeah, we've given it quite a bit of acclaim. And I think other creators and critics have as well. It is a fantastic horror drama series that I am having a really great time engaging with. It makes me think about the real world in a different way, or it makes me think about, you know, the cultural idea of trauma and mimetic iteration and those sorts of hoity-toity words that we could get into at some point, and recontextualizes them in the idea of, you know, shared conspiracy theories and the internet and word of mouth and that kind of stuff. And then to take all of those really interesting academic ideas and have Simmons just deliver this amazing page-to-page, multi-layered, kaleidoscopic art, some of which you own, much to my my jealousy.
Oh, yes, it's at the frame shop. I can't wait.
it's just very, very cool. I can't say enough good things about that book.
It's interesting, like, conspiracy theorists are possibly more dangerous than ever in our society. Yeah. And, you know, these are people that have historically lived on the fringe. And now it feels like they are capable of damaging, you know, democracy. And what a time for this book to come out. Like, just almost perfect. It probably could have came out a little earlier to be even more perfect of a timing. But yeah, this latest issue, it hits close to home for a more recent conspiracy theory that I think people will react to in a big way. My most anticipated book of the week is The Other History of the DC Universe, number one, by John Ridley and Andrea Cucucci and Giuseppe Camicoli. This is a book that has been highly anticipated for quite a while, but DC kind of shelved it a little bit. And it's also John Ridley's, I think it's his first work or its first major work at DC before tackling Batman next year. This is a fascinating Elseworlds take on the other history of the DC universe, where he's going to get into sociopolitical elements and, you know, explore DC's universe. They're saying in previously unexplored ways. So we might be looking at, you know, events or stories that we're familiar with, but now we're going to see it in a sociopolitical way, at a different slant. So it's going to add context potentially and a new perspective that is political. And for that, powerful, I think it could be. I haven't read it, of course, but highly anticipated this for quite a while. And I'm a huge fan of Camicoli. He's done some incredible work on Flash of late, but he's done a lot of work at Marvel, and it's going to be cool to see him tackle historical stories from DC Universe.
Yeah, always a fantastic opportunity to recontextualize stuff and make it your own, too.
Like, I'm so excited for John Ridley, too.
Yeah, like, it's really
cool. He could make a huge splash. I mean, the man's won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave. So,
yeah,
so he knows how to write a word down, you know what I mean?
You could say.
In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we're going to pick our number one piece of cover art out next week to give those cover artists some cred. Because honestly, every week there are works of art that could be probably hung in a museum every single week. My favorite cover art of the week is from Department of Truth number 3 by Trevor Henderson. This is not the main cover. There's actually quite a few variant covers for this book. I think there's like 4 or 5. But this is a truly creepy cover. It features the main man, the main horror story that was introduced, I think, last issue, yeah? Yeah. And it's all teeth and scary eyes, and the star-crossed man is truly a haunting visage. I said this maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago. Like, I think this character design is up there with, like, Freddy Krueger. It could be something that lingers and hangs with us, especially if they get a TV show or movie out of this. But yeah, this cover, truly haunting, and I look at it and I just get like shivers down my spine. Is that right? Yeah, that's scare. That's fear.
Yeah, definitely.
What's your favorite cover art?
My favorite cover art is The Witcher Fading Memories number 1. This is cover art by Evan Cagle and Jeremy Wilson. It features Geralt of Rivia, the Witcher himself, in the center of the page. And actually, the style here is quite similar to Martin Simmons' take on Department of Truth. This kind of, like, acid wash, oil pastel approach. Geralt is kind of fading into this beautiful white grass, and he's surrounded by a number of ghouls from the Witcher series, the names of which escape me, but I know that there are representations of actual monsters in the Witcher games. He's surrounded by them, he's beset by them, and then also kind of in the background, there are more eyes in the darkness, kind of piercing through, looking at Geralt. I really like how monstrous Geralt is depicted here, too. That is a note that is in the novels, but doesn't come through in the games or in the TV show as much. He is altered. He is made mutant to fight these creatures, and I like kind of the parallelism between their depiction and his depiction, surrounded by them, but feeling just as dangerous to them as they are to him. It's a very beautiful layered cover. And again, you throw a cover at me that only has like three colors, and maybe I'm there. I don't know if I'm stupid. I don't know if I can't process more colors than that. I don't know what's going on, but you throw these monochromatic covers at me, and every time I'll pick them out.
Yeah, they're really striking.
I really like it.
They're called foglets.
Oh, okay. Yes, I knew it was something like that.
I'm not a Witcher player, but I did read this issue already, and it is really good. I highly recommend it. It was going to be my choice, but I had to pick the DC Universe book there. This is an amazing cover. If you go to aiptcomics.com and go to this listing, you can actually see the cover in full and check that out. Also, tomorrow, check out X-Men Monday. There is some treats to be had. Multiple, maybe. I don't know. Keep your eyes on aiptcomics.com. Every Monday, there's a new X-Men Monday column, and Chris Hassan does a great job. But moving on, in our next segment, Steve Orlando will join us for an interview. We'll be talking about The Pull from TKO, as well as some other of his works. And enjoy.
Thank you.
Wear your mask.
Wear your mask. Black Lives Matter. Trans rights are human rights. Check out the AIPT Patreon.
Oh, yeah. Forgot to add that.
Throw that stinger on there.
Join us on Discord, where you can probably ask me and Forrest questions about the show while we're planning it. Yeah. We will even tell you who the next guest is, maybe. So on with us is Steve Orlando. Thank you so much for taking the time, Steve.
It's my pleasure.
Congratulations on The Pull launching with Ricardo Lopez Ortiz, Triona Farrell. As a non-traditional series, how has your first project with TKO gone from start to finish?
You know, it's been great. TKO, they're very decisive, and I find myself saying that a lot, but it's good. It's great, actually, because, you know, they really commit to a project, and The Pull was a long time being built, finding the right artists, and when we locked in Ricardo, it all fell to place after that. You know, we knew that Triana was going to deliver on Ricardo's work. I have long worked with Thomas Maurer. And that's kind of something I should point out, too. You know, this was only the third wave for TKO, but they had enough faith in me to take my recommendations on folks like Thomas, who I've been working with for like almost 20 years now.
Wow.
And just from top to bottom, they were there to support us and get you folks the best book possible. You know, they put us through the ringer and beat that story out with me and beat the art out with the rest of the team to make sure it was the best thing it could be. And I think the results are on the page. I've never had a book that I've been part of look like this. I think it's truly a unique work, and with a different editorial team, a different publishing team, that never would have happened. They really set us up and set the product up for success. And there were no half measures. And I think, again, like, it's a killer book. It's a beautiful book. And that wouldn't have happened without them.
Yeah, TKO books are always, they feel like almost like a launch of a movie or something, because there's all this anticipation without new books coming out all the time, like at other publishers. And yeah, you're right. Like, this is only the third wave, which is so exciting. I have to say, like, has The Pull been done? Has it been sitting for a little while before you've been able to, like, really talk about it and get people's reaction?
Well, I mean, I've been done for a minute, but that's because we wanted to give Ricardo a pretty comfortable schedule so that he could deliver. Yeah. And as well, so that Triana and Thomas could deliver. So, yeah, I've been done on my end for a minute. But otherwise, like, you know, we probably finished up midsummer. And that's good, because it's been hard not to talk about it, you know? I wanted to tease it when I did my Hollywood Reporter article at the end of January, because I mean obviously I was already in production then. My part was almost done.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even tease. It was killer. But they did let me say that I was working with TKO. I mean, you'll go back to that interview and I mentioned working with TKO on something, and I'm wearing a damn TKO shirt. So, you know, we had the Easter eggs for you. but it's so, yeah, we probably finished up around the summer and got it out to you. I can't imagine waiting longer, man, because every time stuff was coming in, I wanted to tell people more. But luckily, they started teasing it around July or August on the social, and I could at least be like, hey, what is this? You know?
Right.
Put my become a human eyeball emoji like I do sometimes. And then, you know, before you know it, we had the announcement in October, and here we are. So,
I mean, you were on the show back on March, and like, we were talking a little bit about Darkhold, and I'm still dying to see that. And I don't even know when that's going to come out.
Hopefully soon. It's, you know, a lot of that is in the, a lot of that is in the hands of the pandemic.
Putting the poll down, I was like thinking to myself, did Steve Orlando like interview scientists? Because the science in this book feels real, but then at the same time, it's like, no, this could all be made up. What went into the science aspect of the science fiction in the poll?
Well, the hope was, I mean, first of all, I mean, especially in the pandemic era, it's not as though I can just roll up to, I mean, I do live in Boston, but I can't just roll up to Harvard, excuse me, and be like, hey, you know, explain this to me.
Yeah.
But it is still science fiction. So sort of what the approach was to have, you know, honestly do what I think our job is. Like, even science fiction should feel well thought out, well realized, and it should feel like it should have rules. I mean, if it's science fantasy, that's something totally different. But to me, it was like, okay, we're going to have this thing hard heat. That's going to be our change. And then we can build out what might happen around that. And we just set a lot of hard and fast rules about what it might do to the world, how it might change the world. What the Horizon officers can do. So, you know, I tried to alter science in this world that one way, or fictionalize it, if you will, to hit on the type of genre we're doing, and then make sure that I kept to those rules, because that's what makes it feel super real, you know, like super real. Obviously not real. We don't have people floating around, and hypothetically, it's not the apocalypse, but... I think good science fiction, it sets the changes and it sticks to them, and it isn't just anything goes, because once that happens, you do feel like it's fantasy, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I think it's a different thing, you know? So I mean, other than doing a lot of research myself and doing a lot of reading myself, there are no advisors on it, other than story advisors and story training, to know that we had to still, you know, we had to still tell a story that worked within the bounds of the world we created. And it feels like we did that. And
yeah,
you know, it's super, super pleasing to me the way people are responding, because, man, I didn't know. I haven't done a book like this before. And the response has been great. I haven't really, for better or worse, being on exclusive contract, I was mostly doing superhero science fiction, if anything. And so it's kind of interesting to retrain myself and really do what I would consider hard sci-fi. Although that said, I wrote Martian Manhunter as if it was a hard sci-fi book as well.
That's true. Yeah, really well done. I mean, the fact that the science feels so real, I think, is a testament to your creativity, right? To make it so realistic, to my mind at least, that I believed it. I was like, is hard heat a real thing? Might be.
I actually thought back, it's a very subtle, like, deep cut allusion to, like, the relatively mundane way that they named the stuff that gave Jay Garrick his super speed, which I think they called it heavy water. And I just
remember, oh, okay, that's interesting.
So it weirdly sounded so scientific to me because it sounded so mundane. You know, like it didn't have some sort of name like, oh, like hypertextual nuclear water. No,
that's funny.
You know, it's like in real life, it's like, oh, this fancy thing we don't know about is just called dark matter or dark energy. And so I thought back to, I mean, that's a cut for four people that remember that Jay Garrick got his powers from heavy water. But that's really where I was coming from with stuff like that, because again, it both sounds simple enough. Maybe it is real, but it's not. It doesn't make any sense. Heat can't be hard, and even less than water can be heavy. You know, so here we are.
Right. On the flip side, the pull kind of feels a bit like a video game at times. Like Dem reminded me of Mega Man in a sense. I mean, he's got this rocket arm kind of thing, and he can zip around. Were video games at all an inspiration to the story? And do you play video games?
I think gaming isn't specifically an influence like any one game, but the energy and the frenetic nature of it and the bigness of them For sure. You know, and obviously things like Dragon Ball Z, you can't do a book with and not have a DBZ influence. That said, our next pitch that we're working on is going to be even heavier into that. Like it's going to be like a one-to-one Ricardo and me. So when you'll see it when you know, but it's basically me, weird Russian folklore guy, and Ricardo, lover of things exploding and being punched in the face, putting a thing together. So that's a non sequitur, but keep an eye out. But for gaming, I've gotten into it a little more. I was out for like a long time, mostly because stuff got too hard for me in a physical sense. I'm a pretty big Luddite. Like I'm a type of person who has to buy like two coffee machines because I will destroy the first one in a rage while assembling it. So. Like the minute
controllers aren't going to last.
No. I was like N64 and then shit got too complicated. So I've been out for like decades, but my boyfriend now is in and we're finding things that we can check in together on and enjoy together. So we were playing like Ni No Kuni for a while, which is a gorgeous game. And then, you know, it's much like getting back into wrestling after being gone for 20 years, because a guy I liked when I was a kid came back, which in this case was Sting coming back 5 years ago. Yeah. I didn't really get into a game in the modern era until Mortal Kombat 11 came out, which is written by also a great comics creator, Sean Kittleson. And the lore was great. The story was great. And the gameplay was really, really fun. And so now I'm at least on a couple franchises, like I'm catching up and I'm getting back in. So yes, the NetherRealm stuff. And I kind of want to check back in on Tekken as well, because I enjoyed that when I was younger. I have Tekken 7 on Game Pass, but I haven't played it yet.
Oh, yeah, that has a newish comic series, I think. Came out a couple months ago, actually. But back to the poll really quick. The ending, I found it so beautiful. And I don't want to spoil anything, but the ending I found so beautiful and almost the sentiment of it romantic, if that makes sense. Did you come up with the series with that ending in mind? Because it was so, I thought, powerful to me that it almost felt like maybe you started there.
Well, yeah, I mean, the ending we did know, I mean, pretty early on, the way we told it evolved when I sort of discovered how Vona was going to act in the story. So I didn't know it was going to end with like a Tom King story, but, it became clear once we established it, you know, her whole gimmick is that she will basically like use the fantastic to distract people from reality. I was like, oh, well, what, there's no other way to end this book as something terrible happens. But is it terrible? You know, that's the question. So we knew that there was going to be no easy way out, because it's a book about responsibility, and it's a book about us fucking ourselves, to be honest. So, and it could have, you know, and from the start, in addition to being a sci-fi book, I wanted it to be like a science fiction take on like a Crisis in Infinite Earth type event, which isn't to say like all the heroes come together, but it's like the villain is very much in their threat, not even a villain, is very much in the vein of the antimatter wall or like Mageddon from the late 90s. You know, it's this chronic thing you can't really argue with. So with that in mind, I wanted people to respond to it in a different way, like I thought sci-fi characters would, and with the sci-fi conventions, where there doesn't always have to be like some sort of MacGuffin that saves the day in a way that is clean and easy. Right. And I think that we've sort of, I mean, even in a book about Commanders in Crisis, which is coming out now too, like, I don't think the way that wraps up in 12 is going to be the clean bow, like put a button on it, put a bird on it type shit that you would have gotten in like 1988. Not only because I was three, but because the demands and responsibilities of storytelling have changed. So I don't think we could have done a book like The Pole and given just a clean, like squeak, squeak, like smiley ending, but if you found hope in it, that's really important to me and moving to me, because it's not the ending you expect, but I think there is something positive there. And for a race of people who, I guess spoilers, aren't immortal, it's something we all think about from time to time. And if I can't make you fucking think while entertaining you, what am I doing here?
You know, you just mentioned Commanders in Crisis, and in that, you know, people are talking, you know, they're destroying the earth as well. There's a toxic nature to humanity's effect on the world and all the people around them. Can you talk a little bit about why that theme seems to be coming up in your work right now?
Well, one of it is scheduling. Like, I always try to give you guys the answer, and I wrote these books like a year apart. So things have changed in the real world. But that said, I can feel it being a general theme in my work of the past, like, say, year and a half. I've done a lot of work with identity and sort of like anger, identity-based anger. And I think that this sort of question, I mean, we write about in a subtextual or supertextual way sometimes, in addition to the obvious ways, the things that are on our mind, even if we don't want to. And look, I mean, these are the things that are on my mind right now. You know, you sort of wonder, you're wrestling with a lot of big questions of things that you thought were norms and givens about humanity in the year 2020, you know, from a ton of vectors. And I'm not just talking about only one thing, although there are some major stressors in the world right now. Mm-hmm. And so you're raised to think that certain things are a given. But what if those, you know, what if those towers and pillars start to crumble, and you know, I'm a creator. So what can I do but approach that in my work and put stuff out there and give my own theses about how we might deal with that, whether it's good or bad or hopeful or depressing, hopefully not depressing, even if you might think they are, the answers are at first glance. I think the ending of the poll is a little challenging because we want to believe that we're important, that we are always going to make it out because we matter, even though the reality is, again, not to piss on myself or you or anyone else, like in the 100,000 year plan, we don't matter. The world matters. So we wanted to say something with the poll that shows you that there can still be hope in that. And again, like the only other thing I'd say, like the environmental allegory, the global warming allegory of the poll is not subtle, but I think it wrestles with the reason that people sort of struggle with it sometimes. It's hard. I always remember years ago, DiCaprio was accepting some award, mm-hmm. and he talked about global warming, climate change. And I got a call from a family member that was incensed. You know, how can DiCaprio be talking about this when, 50 people are being beheaded in some country?
Yeah.
And I understand the emotional response to that because, no, we don't want anybody to get beheaded. And it's hard for us to imagine that something like climate change that we can't see day to day could be more important than that. But the reality is, even if it's not going to happen in our generation, huge swaths of a billion person population dying is more important than 50 people.
Right.
But we lack the perspective of to think about things that are beyond the reach of our own life. So one of the goals from the start, not to make this conversation too serious, but one of the goals from the start was to force that very concept on the characters and see how they deal with it.
Yeah, because I was going to say the book is quite fun. It's action packed. I mean, there's sex in the book. And and at the start, even when pretty early on, when the world knows it's all over, people just party and have sex and do drugs and whatnot. So the book,
same time, yeah,
right. The book isn't just negative or sad, I should say. So that said, if the world was going to end in 6 days, Steve Orlando, what would you be doing? Would you be the one on the couch doing drugs, or would you try to do something in the last 6 days with your life?
I wouldn't be doing drugs, just because for the most part that tends to, Massachusetts is a weed legal state, and anytime like I take an edible or something, it tends to like make me not really understand the concept of time. And if we had 6 days left, I'd want to make sure I was there for every second of it.
That's true.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's a question that I'm lucky that I don't have to have an answer to, in real life. Because I don't know, like part of me is like, oh, I just sit here with my boyfriend and make sure we spend every second. But would I want to do that rather than do something active with him?
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, these are the things we wrestle with in the book, because if you are a person who doesn't believe in an afterlife or something, and there's nothing wrong with people of faith, I don't happen to be one, You know, it's not like you can take the memories with you. So it's a conundrum. Definitely a big conundrum. That's one of the reasons, you know, at least you can go out in a high point in the world of the pool. I think about, there's that Neil Gaiman story about that, like, Duke who wants to go out while having sex and getting crushed by an elephant.
Right. Yeah. Go all out,
you know? And I think there's something to that. I mean, I had, the only thing I can recount is that in like 2012 or 2013, I had a cancer scare and I had to think about this because I was like, oh man. And it really was a conflict for me. And that's something I put into the book. I was like, should I keep going to work? Should I do normal things? Like, cause they're not going to matter. But everything did work out, by the way, obviously, or I wouldn't be here talking about it. But that conflict is something else I put in the book, because it was like, what's the point of going to work a 9-to-5 job if I only, you know, if I'm only going to be here for like a year longer?
Right. You know? Yeah, it puts everything in perspective.
And luckily, everything obviously was fine. But it's a lot to consider. Ironically, I was really worried I would die before I saw Man of Steel, and then when I saw it, I was like,
oh no, that's funny. Yeah.
You know what? No, I won't finish that sentence. But you know, like
the Snyder Cut, though, that's what we really are after.
I'm actually excited to watch it, just in the perspective of I want to see what it's like. I mean, listen, I'm a guy who likes Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, a lot, even though it's a trash fire. Like, at least it's a trash, like it's a garbage fire, but the garbage is full of fireworks. So,
I
have a morbid curiosity for that movie. And at minimum, it's going to have Martian Manhunter in it. So for at least a couple seconds, I'll be sweating and overjoyed no matter what he's doing.
Yeah, that's true. That he showed that picture, right, in some video clip last week. I have to say, when I'm reading the poll and I'm seeing characters swearing and I'm seeing nudity and stuff, I think to myself, I like this Steve Orlando. I wish he could do this with the big two. Does that ever cross your mind? Like, holy shit, like I could have, like, you know, naked men in the background of this Wonder Woman scene and she just like remarks, you know, in some way or whatever. You know what I mean?
To that I would say, see Commanders in Crisis, a book with with no content rating, where we will not be exploitative, but we're going to have a couple firsts as it comes to at least superhero comics. I mean, you know, at the big two, I mean, you've seen what trouble they got in for the bad dick, so I try to steer clear of the, you know, this.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
Things, but now we know Bruce is Jewish at least, so that's nice.
This is true.
But I mean, he already was, because his cousin was Kate Kane, who's all Jewish on his mom's side. But regardless, we're definitely pushing the envelope in a book like Commanders in Crisis for superheroes when it comes to swearing and nudity. But again, where it fits, like I'm not just throwing dicks around.
No, you're not. No.
Although it's funny you should say that, because in the course of working on the poll, It was when Euphoria came out. I've said this on a couple podcasts or interviews. That's how I knew that Ricardo was going to be a good fit for me. We knew each other, but we never worked together. And, you know, the first issue of Euphoria came out, and HBO was so fucking nervous to just be like, hey, guys, don't worry. There's no more than 30 penises in this episode. And I texted Ricardo. I was like, we need to put 31 penises in this book.
is that a fact? Can I count them?
I know it's out of character for me, but I haven't actually counted the penises in the book.
Oh my God. I'm going to have to go look through this, after we get off the call and check that out. Can you, tell us a little bit about the difference between working with TKO and other publishers? I know you kind of went into it earlier, but.
Creative support is not unique to TKO. They are great, but I've had great experiences with a lot of people. So, we'll put that to the side. Give them a massive, massive star for it, but they're not the only ones. I don't want to make it seem that way. Image is incredibly supportive. I mean, everything I've done at Aftershock, they have been incredibly, incredibly brave and supportive on all those books. So, like, I'm not going to say that that's unique. But what is unique is TKO's endeavoring to try something new, and that whether it's with marketing, whether it's with formatting, whether it's with the styles of books. You know, I don't know if I could have gotten a book that looks like this approved other places. And the response has been great, but, you know, publishers can often be risk averse. And you don't really know that till after the fact. So they are bold. They know that we can't keep doing the same things. And that's honestly why I was excited to be approached by them from the outset. Because, you know, when in the present moment, you have to try to innovate. You have to experiment. And sometimes things don't always work. But you don't know that until you do them. So the minute they sat down, we were like, oh, we have three basic distribution models. We're doing bingeable style releases. I was like, oh, like this could, I mean, now we know it works. But back before then, where I was like, even if this doesn't work, I want to be part of it. I want to be known to someone who tried something new and worked with people who were trying new things. And that energy is really exciting to me. You know, hopefully you'll see more from me and them in even newer and more interesting formats as they continue to expand, because that's what I want. You know, like I love the, there's an old school love in me for the standard 20 to 24 page pamphlet. But yeah. I also I love comics that look strange. I love comics that are oddly shaped. I love new delivery systems. You know, our readership is more diverse than ever before, not just in background, but in how they like to consume content. And we have to meet them there. So to know the TKO was up for that from the start, I was super, super excited.
How are you approaching, you know, staying creative during the quarantine? Do you have a routine? Do you have a special workspace where you write?
How am I approaching being creative? Don't you also live in Boston? I think you know. It's called rent.
I do. I'm in Somerville, yeah.
It's called I Have to Pay My Rent. No, I mean, honestly, it is. I've been very lucky to have people, publishers, supporting me during the pandemic. And to be frank, like for a freelancer, my life has not changed that much. You know, I'm pretty privileged in the fact that the only difference is now I exercise in my office instead of at the gym once a day, you know? Uh-huh. So it is in some ways business as usual, but at the same time, I had already decided, I had already done that Hollywood Reporter interview. I'd already said that I was going freelance, and I'd already said I was going to lean into doing original work. You know, I'm not going to work at DC. I'm not going to work at Marvel. I've had amazing experiences of both. The Marvel experience was incredible, and hopefully we can see the fruits of that soon. But look, I mean, I wouldn't be who I was without those companies, but I had already decided that I had to be something more too. So I was already in that mindset of like, let's go out. We're going to hustle our asses off. We're going to deliver a ton of new originals this year. And then, you know, lo and behold, a month after I got off contract, the world was like, well, it's good that you're doing that, because some of the other publishers that people work with are just going on pause for 4 months. So right. I was very lucky that things had already been in place for me. And for better or worse, you know, I've got an idea board in the back. That's why we're not doing a video interview, and it's still pretty full. So I've got a lot more to say, and I keep reading, I keep consuming, and keep putting new things on it every day. So there's no end in sight.
That's awesome. You know, speaking of your projects, Killaman is at Aftershock, I think. I'm excited for that. What do we know when that might be coming out?
It's coming out December 5th-ish. It's coming out whatever the Tuesday is of that week, just because that's when graphic novel releases tend to come out, if they're direct to OGN. In the book market, that said, it's probably out, obviously, the Wednesday of that week or the Wednesday before in comic shops. It's the first week in December, I know for sure. So it's out to print. I'm waiting on my comps, but after what seems like decades, but in reality has been about 2.5 years. I think Philip and I pitched that.
Wow.
I think we pitched that at New York City Comic Con 2018. So it will have been just over 2 years. And we're finally out, and it's not going to feel real to me until I'm touching the book, because it's probably the most personal and my favorite thing I've done. But we're going to be, that time is coming. We're going to be in your hands soon.
Awesome. I can't wait.
And it's a great, great book. You know, it's better than I could do on my own. It's better than Philip could do on his own. To me, that's the joy of co-writing. You know, we broke the ending to that book, and Phil came at it from his like angry mixed martial arts guy point of view. And I came at it from my angry queer person point of view. And we both had different ideas how it should end, but the way that we threaded the needle is better than either of us could do. And to me, that's when stuff goes right. You know,
did you have more time to work on it because of the pandemic?
Um,
like tweaks or text edits or?
I mean, we as always were done pretty well before the art, but we did have some extra time just because they pushed back from June to the fall. We definitely had, once the art came in, we probably had about a month or two more just to torture Jim Campbell, God love him actually, and just do a bunch of lettering edits. But again, I think it pays off, and you can't have too much time as well. Like that was a good amount of time because trust me, creatives, like I could look at a book every day and find some other thing I would love to change. So eventually you got to be like, boom, it is done. We're calling.
Yeah, true. Like a Band-Aid.
I could go and look at the first book I ever did. Well, that's not a good example because obviously I would make changes to that. But even something like Martian Manhunter that I think is the best thing I ever did at DC, I would guarantee I would have 3 pages of lettering notes if I looked at it right now. Like eventually, because times your mind changes.
So
we did have a little extra time because we pushed back the release, but with the right amount of time. Because I mean, look, if we had another year, Philip and I, PKJ and I would be noting that motherfucker for another year. Trust me.
Right. I wonder if there's some like nervous anxiety too, like, oh, we can just keep working on this forever and don't have to necessarily see how the audience react. Although on the flip side, you probably want to know how people will react too.
Yeah, I love reading reviews of my work. Who doesn't? What are you talking about?
Especially on AIPTcomics.com. We actually reviewed the first half. I think we gave it a pretty high score. I can't remember. It wasn't me who reviewed it, but
it was an exemplary score because I'm talking to you right now. I don't remember.
That's the only reason.
People were so generous to the book. I mean, and look, it's good. You know, I mean, I would never say. Well, I mean, I think everything I do is good or I wouldn't put it out there. But this, what I will say is that Kill a Man is much more personal to me. There's thematics in a book like The Polar, Commanders in Crisis that are very personal to me. But The Kill a Man is set in the real world. So it is more raw. It is more real. I mean, again, when I broke the ending with PKJ, I was fucking crying in my living room. And I haven't done that since like 2008.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's awesome.
You know, and even then I tried to wipe my memory, but I couldn't do it. So I'm very excited for everyone to see it. And the rest of the team delivered. And again, Aftershock was incredible on that book. They could not have been more supportive. They could not have been more daring with the content. And I'm just going to be really happy to have it out there.
Let's end on end of the year. What are some of your favorite comics that came out this year?
This year.
It's hard to think back to this year because it feels like 20 years.
Yeah. How long was this year? Like 5 years long?
Yeah. It's a pretty intense year.
No, I can answer that for sure. I loved Once in Future that Mora and Gillen are doing a boom. I just read that. Like everyone, it seems, I loved Blue and Green by Ram V and Anand. But I would also point out a couple other things. I'm giving all these answers that everyone is probably saying, but that's because we have certain things are just really, really good right now. Like I love the X books. I've been on them. I've been everything since House of X. I've been following as many.
Is there a specific X book you like?
I like Teeny's Excalibur a lot. I love Ben on Wolverine because I think Ben, if you've seen him on Instagram, just fucking is Wolverine.
But, he has the voice too.
I can't believe that voice came out of him. The first time I met him at a bar, I thought it was a joke.
Yeah, it is intense.
You know, he sounded like he was going to slap in the ass and say, good game. it was really something. But there's some couple other things too that I should point out. I'm doing a wistful voice because I actually keep the books that I've read recently around for just the scenario, but I've already burned through. Oh, and fucking Little Bird also, like Darcy, what an amazing debut.
Intense.
I couldn't believe that thing. I was like, I have to do a better fucking job at comics. It was so good. And it's also not new this year, but I did finally read all of the Klaus cycle that Grant is doing with Dan Mora. And it's also great. It's also really, really great. And it's nice. A small thing, but if you haven't read the T.K.R. short Night Train by Steve Fox that came out in Wave 3, like it's out now. And it's also, we're actually co-writing a horror book together. It's announced today, Aftershock. And I brought him on because he knows horror so fucking well. And it's also just a great little short.
Are you going to be hooking up with him for Razorblades at all?
Well, stay tuned, my friend. I honestly would love to be part of Razor Blades. Obviously, I talk to James every day. I talk to Fox every day. Fox and I probably talk to each other more than our respective boyfriends because they have normal human jobs.
Right. Odd hours.
I would love to be part of Razor Blades. Hopefully next year. It's mostly a scheduling thing, and convincing James that I can do horror thing. But hopefully we can be on there. And I should point out as well, I think James is doing great stuff on Batman. I love how much is new, like in the same way that I'm talking about TKO, like it is hard as hell to create new Gotham lore, and maybe not everything hits. But sure. I would gladly read a book that had a new concept for Gotham every issue. And this is just me. Like, I don't want, don't come at me in the comments here, but personally, rather than seeing the same, like, top six bat villains, I want those to be in reserve and rest to where they can have real impact. And I want new in between. So I love how much new stuff he's been doing. And I can't support it enough. So I should definitely say that as well. Like I want stuff to feel like it hasn't felt before. I want Gotham to feel like it hasn't felt before. And I want characters that challenge Bruce in new ways. And I think he's delivered that top to bottom. So he should be commended for that.
Speaking of stuff that feels different like nothing before, The Pull, Commanders in Crisis, and Kill a Man coming out soon. Thanks so much for being on the show, Steve.
I'm happy to.